Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, television star Rick Mercer has turned to the printed word. His book, Talking to Canadians, a Memoir, is out now, and he joins us on the show. Welcome, Rick.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So this is a bit of a pandemic project, as I understand it, that you started kind of working on this memoir during the COVID shutdown. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm not going to complain about the pandemic because God knows a lot of people had it worse than me. But if you're in show business, the rug kind of got pulled out from under you. It's hard to work from home when you're in show business. You can be unemployed from home, but that's about it. There's not a lot of options. And I've always been lucky. I've always had a project. I've always had something to work towards. I kind of need a deadline to stay sane in many ways. And so I took my publisher up on the suggestion that I write a memoir, and I started writing it, and I just kept going. And thankfully, it gave me something to do during the pandemic.
You allude late in the book to, you know, the title kind of being stashed away by your partner for your eventual memoir. A, is that like apocryphal? And B, like, had you been preparing notes over the course of your career with this in mind?
No. And when my partner suggested to me 15 years ago or so that the title Talking to Canadians could be used for a memoir, he was joking at the time. Neither one of us really considered that at the time. I don't think you think about that while you're doing stuff and while you're growing your career or what have you. Or certainly I never ever thought about that. But Talking to Canadians was kind of a working title, perhaps, for the show that became the Rick Mercer Report. And that's where it comes from.
Right. So it wasn't that you purposely set it aside
as, No. And I never took notes. And my mother was one of those people. Very early on in my television career, she'd say, "You're doing interesting things. You better write this down." And I thought, "Oh, that's not important." And as luck would have it, when 22 Minutes was created, there was a guy by the name of Jeff Dion in the room. And he was the news guy. He was the producer who taught us what a news show looks like and taught me how to hold a microphone and write sentences like a news person. And he was with me every road trip I ever took. And because he's a journalist at heart, he kept notes, which was fantastic. So when I was writing this, I'd say, "When we were doing Talking to Americans and we're in Little Rock, Arkansas, when was that?" And he flip. And he'd say, "I'll tell you exactly when it was. It was November 19th. We flew this flight. We stayed at this hotel. This was our contact. I still have a number for him." And from that, of course, all of the memories would come back. So I was very, very lucky that he kept notes.
You did have some notes from your trip to Bosnia and your trip to Afghanistan, though, right? Because you do weave in some of your diary from those trips.
Yeah, but I'm not someone who keeps a diary. I kept a diary specifically on those trips because I think one of them was published in the Toronto Star or something, and the other one, I don't know if it was published or not, but I did it specifically for those trips. And it's not something I kept up my entire life. I wish I had, but
right.
I don't know if it would have been a different book then or not.
Now, you could lean on Jeff to, you know, provide you with the information during like the period of this hour's 22 minutes. But like, you know, a great deal of your story is, you know, youth and kind of getting into performance. How did you kind of backfill a lot of those memories?
Well, I just went with what I remember. And it's funny the way memory works, at least with me. I don't really remember anything about grade four. I look at the grade four class photo and I see the classroom and I'm like, I don't really remember that very much. But grade three, I remembered like it was yesterday, the day that I thought, if I glue my hand to my forehead, this will make Timmy Green laugh hysterically, which it did. And then it turned into a quasi-medical emergency. But I remember that like it was yesterday. And I remember the first time I was on stage like it was yesterday. And so there's certain things that seared in your memory and then certain things that just didn't register, I guess. But at the end of the day, there was enough. Like, I don't really remember a lot of stories of what my brother and I got up to, but there's a story in the book about how we cut a tree off a neighbor's lawn for our Christmas tree because we convinced ourselves at the age of 9 and 7 that they wouldn't notice that the tree was gone, which was magical thinking at its best, as you can imagine. But that was kind of my brother and I slipping into delinquency, juvenile delinquency. And I remember every moment of that.
It sounds like you were sweating it when you write out, you know, that they eventually showed up at your house. So,
oh my God, the people who owned the house that we took the tree from showed up in our house at Christmas and were having cups of tea next to the tree. and saying to my parents, can you believe someone cut a tree off our lawn? And my brother and I were like lying on the floor and I was dying. I don't think to this day I've ever experienced anything like that. And every now and then my brother would look at me and he'd give me the universal, I'll kill you, you know, the swipe across the neck. And then they got up and said, okay, well, Merry Christmas. And to this day, I don't know whether they were there to torture us and they knew it was us or they were oblivious. I have no idea.
And you probably didn't service them a copy of the book when you...
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Listen, this is me. I called the lady. She's in her 80s, of course. They're still both alive. And I called her and I said, hi, Jane. Hi, it's Rick Mercer calling. She's like, oh, my, how are things? I said, oh, very good. You know, I just... I wrote a book. She said, oh, I heard about that. I'm going to pick up a copy. I said, no, I'll drop you off a copy. And just so you know, I cut the tree off your lawn and I got to go. So I was literally confessing. And then when I finally did get down to Newfoundland, I had the book in my hand and I rang the doorbell and I thought, just put it in the mailbox and run. Like I was like 7 years old again. Sure. But they came to the door and I gave them the book.
In terms of like writing a book like this, and particularly writing those like earlier years where you can remember like a specific instance, are you drawing on like your own career as a writer, like a joke writer, of like, you know, having kind of a punchline and then building around or towards it? Like, are those memories kind of like the landing points for the stories?
I guess I'm a storyteller. I like to tell stories. But I think anytime anyone sits around, and I'm sure if I sat around with you and you started telling me stories from your childhood, you'd probably gravitate to stories that lend themselves to a comedic treatment. And if you've told those stories more than once or twice or three times, they're kind of worked. It's almost like a workshop story. Mm-hmm. I don't think my growing up is, like where I grew up is, sure, it's unique in a certain extent, but it wasn't Angela's Ashes. It wasn't like I had to overcome some great traumatic childhood or something. My childhood was pretty ideal, but unless the stories are captivating, then why would they be of interest to anyone? But I guess that's where the storytelling comes in. But I didn't make up stories or do anything like that.
Oh, I wasn't trying to suggest making up, but just
in
terms of like, you know, filling out details or kind of not embellishing the moments, but like giving them vibrancy.
I think certain things lend themselves to a comedic treatment. So if I'm telling a story about the newspaper, the underground newspaper I started in high school with my two buddies, and the principal tried to suspend us because he was so offended at the content. That was, yes, it was a pivotal moment in my teenage years, but because it was an underground newspaper and it was successful and we got in trouble and we almost got suspended and all these things happened, it's a funny story in of itself, and it's the type of story that deserves a comedic treatment. Whereas if I just told a story about just something else that we did, then it mightn't be worthwhile including, just for the reason that it's not very amusing,
right?
If that makes any sense. You know, I went on a field trip to Montreal, which was pretty exciting, you know, when I was a teenager in high school, but I don't remember anything about it and not much of a story there.
So enjoyable but not memorable.
Yeah, I didn't bother mentioning it. And oh, by the way, I once tried out for a basketball camp. That didn't work out. Yeah.
Sure enough. You mentioned that, you know, being a pivotal moment earlier in the book, you talk about a van full of hippies, this theater performance with this Uncle Val character, and that being kind of the moment when you decided theater was possibly a life for you. Performance was something that you gravitated to. In terms of the importance of a like opportunity like that, is that a sliding door moment for you? Do you think like what
oh, for sure.
If I hadn't?
Oh, for sure. I say, like, I'm not a really reflective guy, so I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about my childhood before I wrote the book, but I do say that I feel like I was miscast as a child. I didn't have an unhappy childhood. I wasn't depressed or anxious or any of those things. Everything was fine, tickety-boo. But I did find myself constantly amazed at the kids around me, how much they were into stuff. And I wasn't in any of it. Dinosaurs, sure, fine, but I wasn't into it like some kids were, and they'd have an encyclopedic knowledge of all of the dinosaurs or anything, any sport, anything at all. Nothing captivated me the way kids become obsessed with things and they go through phases. You know, we all probably know a four-year-old who's obsessed with trains for a year or so. I just never had any of that. And then this one day, I overheard a teacher refer to them as hippies in a van. We were brought into the library and these actors and musicians did this show for us. And it was, the proverbial light went off. I'd never seen anything as exciting. I never found anything as frightening and or as funny. It was just totally captivating. And at the same time, not only was I loving it, I was completely captivated by the fact that there's these people, adults, kind of, I guess, I don't know how old they were, but adults, and this is their job. This is what they do. They do this, they do this all day. And after that, anytime anyone said, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I wasn't going to say firefighter or doctor or astronaut. I just would think of those hippies in the van. I maybe didn't talk about it out loud, but I just thought, wow, I saw the best thing you could possibly do with the life. And it was that. And then years later, when I was in my probably you know, 11 or 12, a TV show came on called The Wonderful Grand Band that involved some of those people. And it was a CBC St. John's production or CBC Newfoundland Labrador production. And it was a huge comic hit in Newfoundland. Everyone watched this show. And it was Newfoundland actors, Newfoundland comedians, and Newfoundland musicians. And then really the light went off that there were people just down the street who were making a living in television. And that's all I ever really wanted to do after that.
Well, from the hippies in a van, there was also the clown in the car, Benny the clown. You
dropped
out of school and started, you know, going around the island with him.
Yeah, I literally ran away and joined the circus. Yeah.
The takeaway that I got from that was just the understanding of, you know, bringing a show to people who wouldn't normally get to see a show.
Well, that's Benny. You know, I was a kid who was hired to drive the station wagon and help Benny on the road. And I loved doing it because I felt like I was leading the most exciting showbiz life. But Benny was would do one-man clown shows. And he had a missionary zeal because you could go into a school. I think we charge $1 a kid. So you go into a school, there's 500 or 600 kids. You get your $500 or $600, and then you might even be able to do another school the same size that afternoon. And then you might do another school the same size a couple of days later. But then Benny would get on a coastal boat and travel a day and a half to a community that had a school of 30 kids. And it would take us 4 days to get in and 4 days to get out. And he would basically subsidize it because he just felt that what he was doing, that was part of what he was doing. He wasn't just being an entertainer in schools. He was making sure that kids on the south coast of Newfoundland, the coast of Labrador, super isolated communities would get to see a clown show, get to see some theater. And he would show up and it'd be the same price for them as anywhere else, which is absurd on paper. I mean, Benny's not the government. He was just he was a hippie. He's just a hippie with a heart of gold and really believed in bringing theater to kids. And I'm sure there are thousands and thousands of kids that were adults in Newfoundland, but the first time they ever saw a show was Benny and me doing the backstage stuff and appearing in my cameo as Bucky the Robot. And for a lot of them, in some of the isolated communities, it might be the only time they ever saw anything like that.
Now, I'm wondering, like, did that eventually kind of like inform some of your willingness to like go out into the country at large and, you know, approach them on a really kind of generous basis that you weren't going to go there to punch down or make fun of them, but to like engage with them and really find out their stories? Like, you know, that it seems to be kind of along the same lineage of kind of thinking.
I wish you'd asked me that question while I was writing the book, because now that you asked the question, I realized that yes, actually, those trips with Benny and also trips with my father and family down the south coast of Newfoundland to these very, very isolated communities very much did inform my attitude towards smaller communities and folks who live in them when I was doing the Mercer Report. In fact, as you said, I can now draw a straight line right back to it. So I wish maybe if there's ever an updated version.
For the paperback. There you go.
For the paperback, because it's absolutely true. I loved going to those communities and I loved exploring them. And I knew there were great people there and there's great stories there. So it came as second nature when I had the chance to do the Mercer Report, that's where we would go. Never mind. What was I going to do? Just go to Calgary all the time? Just go to Winnipeg? Just go to Edmonton? Just go to Halifax? How long can you keep that up? But if you look beyond those major cities, and certainly we went to those major cities, but if you look beyond those major cities, suddenly there are thousands of options to create a unique episode this week. But if you're just relying on the big centers, well, you'd run out of things to do pretty quick, I think.
Well, it sounds like it was the same kind of mentality that when you went to DC and then stopped kind of going to DC on the regular for Talking to Americans and decided, you know, Little Rock and these other places afforded you new opportunities and especially new places to eat.
Absolutely. That very similar. We started doing Talking to Americans in Washington. And originally, when we went back, we're going back to do another Talking to Americans. We'll go back to Washington. It was Gerald who said, what are you doing that for? You can go anywhere. And so we went to Little Rock, Arkansas. And eventually, we would just choose places we would go based on restaurant reviews, because the two guys I was traveling with liked to eat as well as I did. So it was a great job. But we were very careful about where we went. You know, I went to Little Rock, Arkansas, and then we did a couple of trips down south. And then people suggested, well, you know, he's going down there and he's making fun of people from the south. And even though I was making fun of what Americans knew about Canada, I thought, well, I hope it doesn't come across like I'm making fun of people from the south, like I'm buying into some stereotype. So then we changed tacks. They said, not only will we avoid the south, we'll go to Harvard, which is not that far away from Canada. And it's Harvard. And these are stereotypically, cliche-wise, the smartest people on the face of the planet. We'll see what they know about Canada. Turned out they knew about as much as the people in Little Rock, Arkansas. So I was always cognizant of where I was and to spread it around.
And that ties back to that, like, not punching down thing that you employ, or at least...
Well, the not punching down thing was something that we really brought into play for the Mercer Report. And the philosophy was, on our show, we don't hit on Thunder Bay. If we're going to go to Thunder Bay, it's because it's the greatest place on Earth. And you know what? For a lot of people who live in Thunder Bay, it is the greatest place on Earth. They never go anywhere else. Give them all the money in the world. They're happy right where they are. And you can say that for so many communities across Canada. And there's just celebrating a place. Celebrating doesn't come naturally to comedians. It's not how they get into the business. It's not a natural lane for comedians. I'm not saying it should be for everyone. But we just decided to take that tact because it's something I feel really passionate about. I remember being one of the few times I got in trouble, not in trouble, but I really put the show in a little bit of danger. Was I was on Parliament Hill, and on Parliament Hill, not a lot of people know this, it's totally inside baseball and not that interesting, but it's the Speaker of the House of Commons. That office controls so much on Parliament Hill. Ultimately, they're the ones who control where you can shoot, what you can do. If you need special permission or a favor to do something, which we did all the time. For example, we wanted to shoot at the very top of the Peace Tower and take the flag down and put the flag up and play the clarion bells. You need the permission of the Speaker's office. If you're going to try to get things done in Ottawa, you need the Speaker's office on side. And we were in the Speaker's office one day, and there was a person who essentially was running the Speaker's office. And I won't give you the year or any context because I don't want to signal them out. But they said, I happened to mention I was from Newfoundland, and they said, oh yeah, very good. And then a colleague of mine that I was traveling with volunteered that he was from Winnipeg. And this person said, oh, I'm sorry. And I just, to me, it was like, I know they were just cracking a stupid joke, but coming from Newfoundland, I'd heard that all my life. You'd say you're from Newfoundland, people would make some stupid crack about Newfoundland when they'd never been there. And when that person said that about Winnipeg, I just lost it. It was like my brain exploded. And I was like, my internal monologue came out. And I found myself saying, what do you think? We're coming in here in the Speaker's office of the Parliament of Canada to be insulted, to listen to someone shit on Winnipeg? You think that's acceptable? And while I was doing it, I was going, what are you doing, Rick? What are you doing? These people can make your life miserable. What are you doing? But I couldn't stop myself. And I guess it's just something that's ingrained in me. And I liked, this is part of what I thought was the mission we were on with the show, is showing people what St. John's, Newfoundland is like, showing them what Winnipeg is like, showing them what Northern Manitoba is like, showing them what Iqaluit is like, because so many people are quick to pass judgment. They've never even been to the place. How many people in Western Canada will say some snotty thing about Montreal or Quebec and they've never been there? How many people in Quebec will make some snotty, dumbass comment about people from Alberta and they've never been there either? So I thought we were doing a little bit week in and week out to maybe fight that.
Right. Now, you started in the theater, but in the book you write that, you know, you're on your first set, you found TV and movie sets far more intoxicating than the theater. I'm wondering, like, what exactly was intoxicating about it? What was it that drew you in to that versus the stage? Because a lot of actors typically say that the theater is their kind of true love, right? Like, you'll get film actors who are like, I'd rather
I'm the opposite. I was doing, when I had the sketch comedy troupe, my buddies and I would sit around like you do when you're in a band or whatever, and you think about what you're going to do. And we were like, okay, so we'll get a sketch comedy troupe on the go and we'll do sketch comedy. Then we'll go to Toronto, I guess. And then apparently you go to a bar called the Rivoli because that's where the kids in the hall went. And then apparently Lord Michaels is in town for a wedding and wanders in, and then he doesn't take you to Saturday Night Live, but instead he produces a TV show for you. So we'll do that. We'll go to Toronto, play the Rivoli. Lord Michaels will see us. We'll get a TV show. That was the plan. Seemed like a simple plan, straightforward. That didn't really happen. And eventually the comedy troupe, like all troupes, break up. And I started doing one-man shows with my partner producing. But by that point, even before we did the first one-man show, we had our eye on television. That's where we wanted to be. So we viewed the shows as a way to get the CBC to notice us, as a way to get an audience, and as a way to get on television. That was what I wanted.
Was that in part because your partner had like directorial like experience and some TV experience?
Well, he was never a TV. He was never
only a theater director. That's right.
Yeah, he was a National Arts Center. Yeah, but he didn't direct a hell of a lot. He directed my shows. They worked out. He was a producer, and he was a young producer then, but he had ambitions to produce theater for television for sure. And he was an associate producer of the Codco series, which was a comedy show. So he had experience, and that's what we wanted. And it's just, so we viewed it as a way to get there. It's like stand-up comedy. You know, there's certain stand-up comedians that view stand-up comedy as an, and they're always looking for an off-ramp to television or film or whatever. David Letterman was hands down one of the great stand-up comics of his generation. The minute he started the Letterman show, I don't think he ever did stand-up ever again, other than a monologue. But, and no one's ever thinking that there's going to be a David Letterman stand-up tour. But you take a guy like Norm Macdonald, it wouldn't have mattered what success came his way. Nothing would ever stop him from doing stand-up. Same with Seinfeld. God, Seinfeld. He retired with how many hundreds of millions of dollars in a private jet? And he decided to do stand up and not repeat a single joke that got him the TV show, because that's what he is. He's a stand up. But I was never a theater guy. I might go back to the theater, but I'm not one of those guys who worked in television, but then get a few drinks in and go, but really my first love's the theater. Everything else is garbage. That's not me.
Well, yeah, I was curious if it's like, you know, a lot of the argument for the theater is like the responsiveness of the crowd, like the immediacy of the reaction versus.
Yeah,
kind of like
although
the...
a lot of the television I did had a live studio audience. And if they weren't reacting to me live in the studio, they were reacting to the playback of me in a Callowin or whatever. So that audience was always there. And I always got that out of my system, because I would be performing in front of them every week as we taped the show. So the audience is never really that far away.
Right. Now in school, when you had electives, you took creative writing and in world affairs.
Yeah.
Like consciously, did you know that would prepare you for, you know, a great deal of what
Well, I only had really two interests. Well, but my first interest, that I know I'm kind of contradicting myself because I said I wasn't interested in anything, but I always had an interest in politics. My godfather was in politics and had great chats with him. And he would talk to me as when I was a kid, like an adult, or at least someone whose opinion mattered. And I just always found politics interesting. So it would make sense that I would study world affairs when I was given the option. And what was the other one you said? What did I study?
Creative writing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I always liked that. I just barely got through school, but I always did well in English and I always enjoyed reading. So anytime there was any kind of creative essay writing or anything, I did well at that kind of thing. So I knew if I was going to have a hope of passing a course without doing that much work, it would be something like that. So it would make sense.
You know, met your partner fairly early in your life and you kind of got into your career, you know, pretty much right out of high school. Did landing in those two things that early on and then having like a lifetime to grow in those roles help you over the years as far as, you know, kind of being secure as to who you were as a performer and as a person?
Maybe. You know, I was very lucky. I was on television pretty early age. One of my regrets in life is that I was such a bad student. And years later, when I was with the Mercer Report, when we would shoot on university campuses, there wasn't a day that I didn't shoot on a university campus where at some point I looked up and went, wow, I wish I had the opportunity to do this, because it just looks like such an exciting thing to me as an outsider who never did it. But the reality is, when I was their age, when I was 21 years old, I was on a TV show that was getting 1.6 million viewers every single week. I don't think I don't regret the road I went on. I was really, really lucky. And yeah, it certainly prepared me for a lot. You know, I had very little appetite for bad behavior on a TV set, but I witnessed lots of it early on in my career. And that made sure that for 28 years, I didn't. You learn a lot, but it's a bit weird. It's like getting thrown in the deep end. I guess it wouldn't be, it's not that much different than some 21-year-old who gets a couple of years playing professional hockey or something. It's, there's certain sacrifices, believe it or not. They don't go to university. Some of them remain uneducated. They might get into all sorts of trouble because at a young age, suddenly they're in that position and they'd be better suited a couple of years later, but that's not who signs hockey contracts that early. So I'm not complaining, but it was great for me. And luckily I didn't go down any bad roads. I didn't become a cokehead or a diva, I don't think.
Right.
But it's a lot to kind of wrap your head around when you're 21 years old.
No, absolutely. You talk about, you know, as a writer, the like, just how daunting a blank page can be, and whether that's, you know, your one man show that's at the atelier, or, you know, week to week on this hour's 22 minutes. Was it the same feeling when it came down to writing, talking to Canadians? Like, did you like, when you opened that Word document?
Oh yes. And I never would have done it if I didn't had agreed to it. And I had a deadline and I need that. I knew that I wouldn't, if I didn't agree to do the memoir, I knew I was not going to be one of those people who spent the pandemic writing a short story or writing a movie script that I was interested in. I could do that, but I need to have an agreement in place with someone who says, this is your deadline. This is when the movie's due. And I need to know that if I don't deliver it on that at that time, then there'll be people who'll be very disappointed. That's the only thing that motivates me. So yeah, I agreed to do it. And then I sat down and looked at the blank page and thought, oh my God, what have I agreed to do? It's the tyranny of the blank page, but it's the only way that I'll get anything done.
So do you like, is it the same approach in terms of like how you filled a blank page when you were writing for the stage or for the screen to write a book like this? Like, did you draw on the same skills you'd developed over those years?
Not really, because it was a huge learning curve. Everything I've ever written, probably I'm most well known for writing the rants, mm-hmm. and the rants I've done for my entire career. You write 5 or 6 pages and then you start distilling and distilling and distilling until you got it down to a page and a half and it's 90 seconds. So everything I've almost ever done is all about keeping it short. Whereas a memoir is obviously, it's the opposite. It's long form. You're telling a story that has a beginning, middle, and end and goes over 50 years. Very different than writing anything else that I've written.
Well, this book has a beginning and a middle, but the final chapter is called To Be Continued.
Well, because I hope that I'm not at the end. If I get hit by a car tomorrow.
Oh, and I'm not saying, but like it only takes us to a certain point in your career.
They'll change that to the end. That's true. And the reason why was I wrote it chronologically, and I did literally Google how to write a memoir, and they said, don't write chronologically. Just start with a story you like. And I couldn't for the life of me think of a story I liked. I was thinking, God, man, you must have a story. And I couldn't think of one. So I said, I'll just start at the beginning. And I did continue writing chronologically and didn't deviate from that at all. And then my editor said, stop, you've got a book now. and it stops at an opportune time. It stops when I moved to Toronto and my partner and I are deciding that we're going to do the Mercer Report.
So has your editor said part two?
Well, there's no file in my computer right now with a blank page calling out and torturing.
No tyrannical Word doc. Okay.
There's no tyrannical Word doc with volume two written at the top.
Well, for now, Talking to Canadians is out through Penguin Random House. Rick, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about the book and congratulations on its release.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you very much. And I love that point that you made. It was very salient.
I appreciate that.
Okay. Bye-bye.